Good morning. We're going to cut the music a little short because we have Fred Malone with us from the Marion Historical Society, and he's got lots of stuff. He has so much stuff, we're going to do 2 days worth of this stuff. And Fred is going to give us a lot of history and background on all the presidents we've had up to. What president are we going up to?
Well, today we're going to go through Rutherford B. Hayes.
Okay. No. So, and then next week we'll go from Mr. Hayes.
Just say RB.
Yeah, up until who?
We're going to finish off with Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford, okay. Yeah. All right, well, let me get rid of my music here, and then we will go on. Okay, welcome to On the Air. I almost forgot what we were doing. I'm Glenn Coble, and we do have Fred Malone with the Marion Historical Society, and I'm just going to open it up to you, Fred.
Okay.
Fire away.
Well, basically, I'll explain to our listening audience what we're planning to do here over the next couple of meetings that I'm with you, and I think the next one will be, of course, the third Thursday in December.
Yeah.
I'm figuring right. So what we talked about prior to the election, we talked about what interesting facts occurred during some of the other presidential elections, because we've had some controversy over this one and some interesting things going on. So what I have done is gone back and researched from George Washington up through Gerald Ford on what actually took place with the elections that got them into the presidency, or in some cases didn't, whatever the case might be. So we're going to talk a lot about the Electoral College and how it had affected elections from George Washington on up, and just try to throw in some interesting facts. And as I was telling Glenn earlier, unless you're a student of history and a presidential history student, I think there's some information here that you'll find interesting that's not necessarily anything that you might know without research. Being a historian myself, I had to go back and do a lot of research to pick up some of this information myself. So
didn't you graduate from college in 2010 or something?
Yeah, add a few more years onto that, and yeah, you might have it right. So I think you'll find it interesting. So we'll go through R.B. Hayes today, and then when I come back in December, we'll pick up from him and go up through Gerald Ford and talk about this.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Now, before I start this, I do want to mention that I occasionally appear on Mike Wilson's Monday Night Show, as you know. And I got a call from Mike the other day wanting to know if I could do a show about Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. So Monday, December the 7th, we're going to do a show on Pearl Harbor, and we're going to talk about how Pearl Harbor had an effect on Marion. And then I have a guest that's going to be calling in with us that night, who is a Navy veteran from World War II, who was actually an aviator. He was a tail gunner.
Wow.
And a radio man, and a TBM Avenger, flew off the short carriers in the Pacific, Don Wilson. And mm-hmm. So we'll have a chance to talk to Don and, you know, ask him some questions about where was he when he heard about Pearl Harbor and that type of thing.
He must be getting up there in age.
He's going to turn 97 shortly after the first of the year. Yes.
I was surprised to hear the other day that there are, I think I heard 30,000 World War II vets still kicking.
That's probably about it. Yeah. And of course, we're losing them at a rapid rate every day.
Yeah.
Up until here, just a year or so ago, we were losing them at a rate of 1,000 a day.
Yikes.
And now, of course, it's considerably less than that because there are considerably fewer left.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, tune in on December 7th, Mike Wilson show at 5:15. Here on WWGH, and we'll talk a little bit about Pearl Harbor and what effects it had on people.
You and I don't remember Pearl Harbor.
No, I wasn't born until 1950, so I don't remember Pearl Harbor.
No.
But I had two uncles on my mother's side of the family that served during the war, one in the Army and one in the Army Air Corps. So I've done some research in my family history, and also, you know, done some studying of World War II as well. So,
excellent.
But I think this show with Don Wilson will be very interesting and very informative. And Don was Senior Citizen of the Year 2 years ago here in our district. He came after me. I was Senior Citizen of the year before that. So, and we've been good friends for a number of years. So,
excellent.
Very nice guy.
I'm looking forward to the show. All right.
Well, I want to first start off with saying that with all this controversy going on with the Electoral College, and there's a lot of discussion as to whether or not the Electoral College, which sometimes can be electrical, has really outlived his usefulness or not. But currently, the Electoral College is based on 538 delegates. And we arrive at that because there are 100 senators, there are 435 members of Congress, and by an act, I think, in the 60s, the District of Columbia was awarded 3 delegates.
Oh.
So we currently have 538 delegates available in the Electoral College. And, of course, the Electoral College is based on popular vote. So each state has a given number, depending on how many members of Congress, and each has 2 senators. So that's how they determine how many go to each state. And the popular vote in that state, whoever wins the popular vote, is to get those delegates. That's the norm. However, in our past, sometimes that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about a couple of those instances today when we talk about the first 19 presidents that we're going to talk about today.
All right.
But that's the way it's broken down today. Now, in the first half of our presentation, there are 4 presidents who were never elected president.
Is that right?
In the first four, in the first half of this, the first 19, there are 4 that were never elected. John Tyler, who served as president from 1841 to 1845, succeeded William Henry Harrison. And, of course, we all know the story of William Henry Harrison. He got kind of long-winded on Inauguration Day, caught a cold and or pneumonia or whatever, and only lasted 30 days. Yeah. So John Tyler took over for him. Millard Fillmore, who served from 1850 to 1853, succeeded Zachary Taylor.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, who also only served a very short time in office. Andrew Johnson, everyone's familiar with, who served from 1865 to 69, succeeded Abraham Lincoln, who was assassinated just a few months after he was inaugurated for his second term.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Chester Arthur, serving from 1881 to 1885, succeeded James Garfield, who was assassinated very early into his first term in office, which I think occurred in July, if memory serves me correctly. So there are 4 presidents that were not elected
as president. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, none of them chose to run as president after that term was
finished. That's it. That is interesting.
That is interesting,
yeah.
Right. So they were one-term presidents having succeeded their boss.
So they really weren't a full-term president.
They were not. Yeah. They were partial-term presidents, but the interesting part of it was they were never elected by the population.
Yeah.
By the population.
Now, I assume back then they were still on the ticket with the president, or was that too early to have both running together?
Yes, they were. They absolutely were. But as we go through this, you'll find that not always was the president and vice president of the same political party.
Yeah, that's what I thought I remember.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Now, interestingly enough, during our history, there were very, very many and very different types of political parties. Not counting the Socialist Party and the Green Party, some of the ones that came along in the latter years of the last century and this part of the century. Those parties that were in existence in the first 19 were the Federalists, the Democrats, the Republicans, the Democrat Republicans, which I find to be interesting, the National Republicans, the Whigs, the People's Party, the Progressive Party, the States' Rights Party, and the American Independent Party.
Holy crap!
Those were all people that ran for president.
Oh my!
That represented those different parties. And of course, then in the more recent history, we've had the Green Party and some of those.
My
parties.
Favorite is the Moose.
Well, and that's the Progressive Party.
Yeah,
that was actually Teddy Roosevelt's party when he decided to run against William Howard Taft in 1912, after Taft had been his hand-picked successor when he left office, but he didn't like the way he was being president, and of course, Teddy started the Progressive Party, known as the Bull Moose Party, which actually allowed Woodrow Wilson to be elected president because it didn't give enough votes to Taft, and it didn't give enough votes to Teddy, and Wilson was the success, was the winner. So, and that's a whole other different story, but that's how that came up. But to start with, good old George Washington.
Yes.
George Washington's first term began in 1789. He had no political party affiliation, obviously, because he was the first president of the United States.
Was he born in England?
Actually, I'm not sure of his birthplace, but he was a British subject, which we're going to talk about later on with some of the other presidents. Didn't check his birthplace. I could probably find it.
That's all right.
But he had no opposition, obviously. And his second term, he was then considered a Federalist in 1792. By that time, they'd started to establish some political parties. Again, he had no opposition. In fact, there are no known popular votes for either of his elections. In fact, he was elected by the Continental Congress or the Federalist government. Now, I want to refer back to a little bit of information here. And I'm going to kind of go back and forth with some of these books that I have.
That's fine.
He was actually notified by a courier that he had been elected president. After the Revolutionary War, he retreated or returned back to Mount Vernon in 1783. Then in 1789, a gentleman by the name of Charles Thompson, who was a secretary of the Congress, and I'm referring to my notes here, I can't remember all this, who was a secretary of the Congress, arrived at Mount Vernon and handed the general a dispatch notifying him of his unanimous election to the presidency. Now, that was the first time.
Okay.
And 2 days after that, he left for New York City, which, of course, at that time was the capital.
Was that unanimous by the Congress?
It was unanimous by the Congress.
Okay.
And I'll give you a little bit more information on that. I'll just refer back to my my little handy book here.
We should do this on television.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun to watch you go back and forth.
Go back and forth. Yeah, yeah. The inauguration of the first president of the United States took place in the afternoon of April the 30th of 1789 on the balcony of Federal Hall, which overlooked Broad and Wall Streets, again in Washington. As Washington came out onto the balcony, he got a thunderous ovation from the people who jammed the streets and housetops as far as anyone could see. Maybe challenging Donald Trump for the crowd.
I don't know.
Then as he took the oath of office in his dark brown American-made suit, a deep silence swept over the crowd. There was not a sound from the streets until Chancellor Robert B. Livingston, who administered the oath, stepped forward to the railing and shouted, "Long live George Washington, President of the United States."
Hmm.
Now, as I said earlier, having not been an election of the people, he was actually elected by the Continental Congress or the Congress of the United States.
Okey-doke.
So our first president actually had no popular vote and no political party until his second go-around. Now, he did have a vice president, and his vice president was John Adams.
Oh, really?
Who received the second highest number of votes from the Continental Congress representatives. So John Adams, who was also a Federalist, served as his vice president.
Were they friends?
Well, yes and no. They were political allies in a sense. However, when John Adams became vice president, he was basically pigeonholed and had no real responsibilities.
Much like many of the vice presidents.
much like many of the vice presidents that have occurred since then. But in the early days, he had no responsibilities and no job to do. Modern-day vice presidents often have some tasks that they're assigned to by the president to be in charge of this project or that project. But Adams basically was just waiting in the wings for something to happen to Washington.
Yeah, a placeholder for Washington.
Yeah. He was there to succeed him in the event of his death.
Yeah.
But John Adams did become our second president and ran for president against Thomas Jefferson.
Huh.
Now, that first time, basically there was no opposition nationally because there was no population voting. This was all still being done by the Congress. So Thomas Jefferson then assumed his position as vice president to John Adams, again following in that same category that he got the next highest number of votes. Now, our third president then was Thomas Jefferson. Now we're going to start to see a little bit of what was going on with the Electoral College. John Adams and George Washington did have a votes, electoral votes, that were given to the delegates in the Congress. So when it came time for Thomas Jefferson to run, he had some opposition, and his opposition, I think everybody will remember, Aaron Burr.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody remember Aaron Burr? So during that first term, are we getting close to break time?
Well, I went through it, so you were in the middle of something, so
okay.
I just covered it up.
so we'll go to a quarter till then?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So when Thomas Jefferson ran in 1800 for president, his opposition that first time around was Aaron Burr. Now, Thomas Jefferson by that time was called a Democrat-Republican, which was actually a combination of both the Democrat ideals and the Republican ideals.
Oh, boy.
So it was kind of a middle-of-the-road type party.
Yeah, yeah.
And interestingly enough, Aaron Burr, his competition was also a member of the Democrat-Republican party. So the 1800 election, which is very interesting, each one of them received the same number of electoral votes, 73 electoral votes apiece. Now, we're going to go back into our handy-dandy book of facts here.
That was brought up several times in this last election because there was a very real possibility that it could come down to a tie between Trump and Biden.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, by the way, before I forget, Thomas Jefferson was actually the first president to be inaugurated in Washington. By that time, they moved the Capitol to Washington. So, on March 4th of 1801, he was the first president to be inaugurated.
They moved it from Philadelphia?
Well, actually, they were in New York.
New York, okay.
Right, they went from New York. This came about. This is interesting. Jefferson and Aaron Burr, both leaders of the same party, each received 73 electoral votes, and the House broke the tie. The House broke the tie. So based on what party was being represented in the House at that time, there were probably a dozen different mm-hmm. parties. They all had their own vote. So the House voted, and it doesn't give the actual vote that came out of the House, but that's how they broke the tie.
Okay.
And by virtue of that, Aaron Burr then became the vice president for Jefferson. Then when Jefferson ran the second time, he had some opposition. And that was a guy by the name of Charles Pinckney. You ever hear that name before?
I think I have heard that name.
He was a Federalist and also a member of the Congress at that time. And their vote came down to, and I go to my book here, there was no question. He had 162 votes, Jefferson, and Pinckney only had 47.
That's
there wasn't any question.
Yeah.
He was actually kicked out by virtue of that, but because he was the second vote getter, he was selected as the vice president.
Okay.
So for his second
term. That's probably why I recognize the name a little
bit. And a lot of the vice presidents, you know, obviously are not very well known in history today.
Right.
But that was how they were choosing the vice president then. It was the highest vote getter. The second trip around.
I used to live on Colfax Street, and I had no idea who
Schuyler
Colfax was.
Absolutely.
But he was the vice president.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that would take us then down to our fourth president, who was James Madison. And James Madison was a Democrat Republican, and he had some opposition in the election. And it was, guess who? Old Charles Pinckney, who had been the vice president under Jefferson.
He had a desire to move up.
So he ran against James Madison. Now, James Madison in this election was a Democrat Republican, and Pinckney was a Federalist. So we had two different parties running at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, James Madison was the victor, as we all know. He had 122 electoral votes to 47 electoral votes for Charles Pinckney.
Pinckney's not doing well on this electoral votes.
He wasn't. But as you're noticing here, a pattern, how many fewer electoral votes were available in the early days as compared to now, because we didn't have as many states.
Yeah, we have a lot more states.
Sure, absolutely. So we were still just basically 13 states at that particular point in time in history. This would have been in 1808 that Madison ran for his first term of office.
Just a few years before I was born.
Yeah, me too. Now, he ran again in for a second term in 1816, and again, he was still a Democrat-Republican, and he had some competition then, too, and you may remember this name from history, DeWitt Clinton.
Yeah.
Remember? He was an inventor.
Yes,
and,
did the cotton gin or something.
Yes, right,
like
absolutely.
That,
yeah. He was an inventor, and he was running as a Federalist as well, and the breakdown on the electoral votes in that particular election was 128 for President Madison and only 34 for DeWitt Clinton.
Really lopsided these electoral
votes. It was.
Yeah.
And again, I think, again, it depended on the makeup, of the Congress and who they had any allegiance to.
Yeah.
And being already in office. I will say that in 1812, when that election was conducted, the War of 1812 had just started to begin.
Mm-hmm.
So Madison, much like when FDR came along 100 and some years later, in the midst of the war, I would assume that the Congress wasn't willing to make any change.
Yeah.
That's a supposition on my part.
Yeah, sounds right.
Just a few interesting facts about Madison. He was the smallest president that we've ever had. I think he was only like 5'4", if I remember correctly.
Oh, my. That is tiny.
Yeah, and of course, he had a very famous wife.
Yep.
Dolly Madison.
She was a great cook.
Who was actually about a head taller than him.
Is that right?
Because of the War of 1812, that was referred to as Mr. Madison's War. Madison's War.
Yesterday we were talking about this, and I told Scott that I was going to ask you, where was Mr. Madison when Dolly took the portrait of Washington off the White House and saved it? Where was he?
Well,
Why wasn't he doing something?
Interestingly enough, the British, of course, had invaded New York and were working their way south, and they'd gotten to the outskirts of Washington, D.C., and they were burning things as they went along.
Right.
They were burning all the public buildings as they went along. And about 2 days before they were figuring that they would arrive at where the White House was at that particular time, because by then they were in the White House. I kind of regress a little bit. John Adams was the first president to live in the White House.
Okay.
It was still under construction when he moved in there. But they spirited the president away to a hill high above Washington where he would be safe.
Left Dolly behind.
Dolly, by her own choice, stayed at the White House to remove some of the things that she felt were valuable.
Okay.
The silverware, some of the furnishings. She actually had a couple of wagons brought up out front of the White House, and
U-Haul stuff.
And started loading things up. And it was actually, there's some confusion here as to what really happened here, and I'm going to set the record straight based on on history. And
you weren't there.
And what historians have taught us. Dolly enlisted the help of Mr. Madison's personal manslave, a man who had been with Madison ever since he was a child. They actually had grown up together, a black servant, and I think I want to say his name was Reynolds, but I might be wrong. There's a book out about him which I have read, but I don't remember his name, but I want to say it was Reynolds. Could be wrong. But Dolly enlisted him and the help of a caretaker at the White House to actually take down Gilbert Stuart's portrait of George Washington.
Uh-huh.
And they used a hatchet to cut the painting from the frame.
Okay.
The frame stayed on the wall, and they actually used a hatchet to go down and cut the painting out and then roll it up to transport it.
I'll be darned.
But that was done as the British were basically on the
knocking
front
on the door.
Lawn at the White House,
yeah.
Right, which then in those days wasn't called the White House, it was called the Executive Mansion, were there to set the White House on fire.
Yeah.
She left with that portrait and some other things from the White House and left town to go to join her husband, who was, again, sequestered on a hill somewhere where they could watch what was going on, but that would be safe. And they did set fire to the White House.
Yeah.
In fact, burn it The complete interior was burnt. There was nothing left on the inside except four basic walls, the four main walls. So they were able to rebuild the White House from the outside, from the inside out, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And actually, prior to the burning of the house, it wasn't really white. It was more of an off-shaded color of white. Okay. And, of course, as you can imagine, being burnt, then it became charred on the outside. So they had to repaint the White House, and that's when they did the basic change of the color of the White
House. So are the stones that are the makeup of the White House, are they the original
stones?
Yes,
the foundation was not destroyed.
Okay.
Right, the foundation was not destroyed. And to jump forward, if you can remember Truman's term in office, Truman... when he first became president, the White House was in such terrible shape that they actually never lived in the White House. They lived
in the Blair
House across the street.
Not
until the very, very end of his term did they move in. He had the White House completely gutted so that, again, in his first term, let's see, which have been
47?
When Roosevelt died. Roosevelt died in 45.
Yeah,
so he had the White House gutted starting in 45, and, I mean, there was nothing left but the original walls and the foundation. And there's pictures that show heavy equipment on the inside of the White House with nothing there, clear down to the stone foundation, which is the basement area, really well below ground, where they completely gutted the whole thing and completely rebuilt it on the from the inside out, because it was completely, it was in shambles. The floors were rocking. It was a mess. It was an absolute mess.
Roosevelt didn't care.
Over 200 years. Yeah, well, over 200 years of not having basically anything done to the inside.
Wow.
But, so after that was burnt, and then had to be completely rebuilt again, they just basically started from the foundation and worked their way up.
Wow!
But Dolly is given credit for saving the painting, which she actually did. But it was with the help of this manservant slave of Madison's, and also one of the gardeners. I think it was he was a gardener there at the White House. Yeah.
Okay, we're supposed to take a break now, and I may have screwed stuff up, so we don't know whether it's going to come or not. So hang with us.
Charlie.
There it is.
Did you know that Mayor Jack Kellogg has a great collection of political memorabilia?
Yes, I did know that. But do you know what his most prized political possession is?
No, Charlie. What is it?
Hillary Clinton's hairbrush. Never been used.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Don't miss it.
GTG, BRB, OMW, be there in a few. You may think that these kinds of texts are fine because of their length, and you can easily send them at a stoplight. But no, answering one text can take your attention away from the road for 5 seconds. And traveling at 55 miles an hour, that's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Make good decisions. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
We have a caller. Caller, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. I just have a comment.
Sure.
We need that man to go to the schools. They don't teach what he's talking about.
Fred Malone knows more.
Yeah.
Fred knows an awful lot, and if you see all the books that are on his table right now, you'd understand he's very organized.
I hope you don't mind me calling.
No,
I'd
love to have
just a breath of fresh air.
Okay, excellent. Well, we've got today, and then the following week, we're going to do the probably 10 or 15 more. So,
that's wonderful.
All right.
Take him to the school.
All right. Well, have your kids listen, all right? Or grandkids.
Okay, I will.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Well, I hope she enjoys it. I hope everyone that's listening enjoy it.
Yeah, I do too.
And it gives you a great idea of how our country progressed, you know, over the years. And the fact that, yes, we're having controversy today, but there was controversy
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, there's been a lot. Yeah.
And sometimes we don't, you know, we don't hear about all that controversy because it's this lady that just called in and said, they don't really teach this in schools anymore. And it's really sad. And that's where I got my love of history was from my education, my early education, from grade school on up. And I've said this before on Charlie's show when Charlie was still here and we'd talk about history. My favorite teacher in school was my 8th grade Ohio history teacher, Wayne Denny, and I'll never forget his name. It's emblazoned upon my mind. Wayne taught me the love of history and the love of Ohio history in particular. In fact, I loved that class so much at the end of the year, I bought the book. I bought the school book that I had when I was in the 8th grade, and I still have it.
In the 8th grade,
yeah,
you knew that you liked it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In the 8th grade, I was just chasing girls. So.
I was chasing history.
There you go.
So anyway, we owe a lot to Dolly Madison for having saved that Gilbert Stuart portrait. And if you've ever seen that portrait, it is absolutely fabulous.
It's been reframed, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. And again, the original frame was destroyed in the fire. So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, moving on. Our fifth president then was James Monroe. Now, James Monroe was a Democrat Republican. We're repeating some of this.
Yeah.
And in his first term that he ran for office, which would have been, 1816. I'll lose track of where I am here. 1816, he had an opponent by the name of Rufus King.
Don't know that name.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it. You know, a lot of these guys you're never going to hear of. Rufus King was... again, a member of Congress at the time. James Monroe beat him by 183 electoral votes to...
Oh, he stomped
to,
him.
I think you're on me, right across the page. To 34 electoral
votes.
Yeah,
he stomped him
so
good.
He didn't do too well either in his time on office.
Well, it sounds like that party was probably one of the strongest party.
At the time. At the time. You started to see more Democrat Republicans in those early years. But that's going to change as we move into the next couple of presidents, and you'll see that pattern kind of developing.
Okay.
So, again, 183 to 34, and then he served as the vice president for him due to the fact that he was the second highest number of votes.
Now, there are a lot more electoral votes in this one than the previous one. So did we add a state?
You've started to see that add up. And I didn't bring my list of when the states came into the Union, but I'm guessing that that probably was the case.
Okay.
And I didn't add these up as I went down through just to see how it was progressing. But you can tell when I read them off that they're starting to increase as states start coming along.
I got a really cool hack on TV the other day. If you ever want to know when Ohio was became the state, which in what order, the Ohio flag has the 13 stars, and then it has four out to the side.
Right.
So you add 4 to 13, and you get 17. We were the 17th state.
In 1803.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was 1953 when it was finally done.
Well, if you want to split hairs.
Yeah, it's splitting hairs.
Okay, so then the second election of James Monroe in 1820... his opponent at that time was John Quincy Adams. Now, John Quincy Adams was also a Democrat Republican. So both of those guys were in the same party at that time. And he actually
strong.
Yeah, he actually beat out John Quincy by 231 to 1.
Oh, my. That's a resounding victory.
JQ only got one. Yeah,
oh,
yeah, which was kind of sad. Now,
he was the son of
he
Adams,
was the son of John Adams, right? And much like his father, he had had a lot of previous history serving the country as a diplomat. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and primarily in England and in France, as did his father. And he spent quite a bit of time in Europe. So when he became president, which he's going to be the next one we'll talk about, he had a lot of knowledge in what was going on in the world, which was good for us because we had just gone through the War of 1812, about 12 years earlier, and we were still reeling from some of the results that had occurred from that war and from the things that the British were trying to impose upon us.
Okay.
So, interestingly enough then... Well, I wanted to mention a couple things about him before I move on. James Monroe really didn't do much of anything while he was in the White House. His 8 years, and he did serve 8 years, he elected two terms, has been referred to as the era of good feeling.
Oh, well, that's not a bad thing.
He was kind of, well, in a sense, I kind of liken him to Warren Harding, because Warren Harding's theme was a return to normalcy.
Yeah.
So.
And until he died, and they found out about Teapot Dome.
Well, yeah,
he was everybody
pretty,
liked him.
Yeah, it was a pretty normal thing, yeah. and that's the same way with Monroe. He was very much liked. There was hardly any controversy that occurred. He was the author of the Monroe Doctrine. So that harmonious feeling that was generated through his time in office kind of brought the country together again after some of the strife that had been going on before that. Yeah. So now we're going to enter into a new phase in our presidential history, starting with our sixth president, who was John Quincy Adams.
Yeah.
Now, John Quincy, having been Monroe's
certainly got more
vice
votes
president
this time.
And trampled on in the election of 1820, in 1824, now John Quincy, who had been a Democrat Republican, now became a National Republican.
Oh. So,
not a straight-out Republican, but what they referred to as a national Republican. Okay. Again, one of these 8, 12 different parties that were in existence in the early years of the country. Oh, by the way, there were some other parties I didn't list that never had presidential candidates, but one of my favorites was the Know-Nothing Party.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember
and there were,
that.
There were Know-Nothings representatives in Congress at that time. And
we have a lot of those now.
Well, they don't go by Know-Nothing, but sometimes we think they're Know-Nothings. And that's kind of another sidebar to history, too. During those early years in Congress, because of the diversity of candidates and people that were representing different factions in the country, there were a lot of fights and canings and shootings.
Ooh.
And that type of place that took place on the floor of the House of Representatives.
It's
a pretty wild place in those days.
Shootings as well.
Shootings. There were a lot of duels that were not conducted in the House, but on the street between congressional representatives, and a lot of canings. They all carried walking sticks in the day. And they'd get into heated arguments, and
whacking
one guy would take after the other with his cane and whop him in the head.
They were just as stupid as we are.
And, of course, if you can imagine, spittoons everywhere because they all chewed tobacco and they spit
over
on the floor. The place was not very well ventilated, so it was dark. It was dingy. It was musty smelling. It smelled of tobacco. It reeked of sweat. It was not a very nice place to be.
Yikes.
But I digress.
Okay.
Back to John Quincy. So now we're starting to see popular vote.
Okay.
Now the people are voting.
Okay.
And we're starting to see popular vote, which influences, in some issues, what happens with the Electoral College. So in the election of 1824, John Quincy received 105,321 popular votes.
Okay.
And his opponent, Andrew Jackson, who was a member of the Democrat Party, received 155,872 votes.
There are a lot of people voting by then.
That's 300,000. Jackson won the popular vote by 50,000.
Yeah.
And in the Electoral College, Jackson received 99 electoral votes. Adams received 84 electoral votes.
Oh, interesting.
Now,
the plot
there was two other candidates involved as well. I don't have popular votes, but I've got Electoral College votes. Henry Clay was a Democrat Republican also in there. He got 37 electoral votes. And William Crawford, another Democrat Republican, got 41 electoral votes.
Now, that's a name I don't know.
But. Okay, so we've got four candidates that split the Electoral College four ways with, again, John Quincy being the second highest number of electoral votes.
Yeah, interesting.
Electoral votes, I should say. So what happened? We've got four candidates. We've got four different electoral votes. How did he get to be president?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
While no candidate received a majority of the Electoral College votes, Adams was elected president of the United States by the House of Representatives.
Oh.
Now, we're going to go back.
That's interesting.
We're going to go back in one of our other books here, and we're going to see if we can find out what the thought was at the time.
Yeah, that's questionable.
Yeah. John Quincy was the only nonpartisan president and the first to receive fewer popular and electoral votes than his opponent, any of the opponents.
Wow.
This came about due to the peculiar system that was in place at the time. In 1884, like we said, there were four candidates, all Democrat Republicans. Jackson received the most popular votes and the most electoral votes, and then Adams came in second, followed by Crawford and Clay. Since no candidate, again, had a majority, the House chose that. The House elected Adams when Clay, who did not want to see Andy Jackson president, released his votes to Adams.
Oh, okay.
Jackson was livid. Adams was unhappy because he knew that he was not the popular choice. So Clay was made Secretary of State, and Adams and Clay then called themselves National Republicans and became later Whigs.
Yeah,
which
okay.
We're going to hear about the Whigs later on.
Yeah, we are.
So that's actually how he became president. He was chosen by the House. Unfortunately for
him... We're down
him,
to a couple of minutes, by
okay.
the way.
Unfortunately for him, when he ran for a second term, he was defeated.
Oh, okay.
And who defeated him? Andy Jackson.
Oh, that's got to put salt in the wound.
Again... Andy Jackson now was a Democrat, and John Quincy was still a National Republican, and the electoral vote there was 178 to 83. So he not only lost the electoral vote, but he also lost the popular vote, 647,000 by 508,000.
Boy, the population, voting population has really gone up in those
years.
It
has. It started to go up as, of course, states start to be added. But what that really proves is that John Quincy Adams was not popular not only from the first time he ran, but the second time he ran. And he only became president on a fluke because there were four candidates that ran for office and no one got a majority.
Now, that raises a question of this current...
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes you start to think, well, maybe he's got a point. It's pretty crazy.
It's interesting.
Well, is this a good breaking point?
It is.
Because we're gonna have to go to
yep.
our big break.
Yep, we'll and stop here. And I think that's a great one to stop on
yeah.
because it was an unusual one up to that time.
Well, we're going to continue this on. You're listening to Fred Malone with the Marion Historical Society and also now a resident president authority. And we're going to take a break. I did want to tell people, if you've got kids that are staying at home, you know, learning on the internet, I'm going to do some stories in the next on Swap Shop that they might be interested in listening to. I'm reading stories about inspirational Thanksgiving stories for kids, and so I hope you'll join us.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio. The place to talk.
When we're joined, this is great pride and privilege for the first time by Joy Bay.